Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started. Today I am super excited, and I think that you are too, because we are going to talk about one of my favorite children's book authors and one of her books. We're talking about the Moffats, but in a way, this is just sort of representative of all the works of Eleanor Estes, who is just one of the most delightful children's book authors, I think, that there is. A lot of people are very familiar with The Hundred Dresses. And if you're not familiar with it, go get it right now. Check it out from the library or buy it. It's not terribly long. You can sit down and read it in one sitting. You can read it to your kids. It is just, it's a wonderful, wonderful book. Lots of incredible lessons to learn from it. And then hopefully after that, you'll be hooked and start reading some of her other books. Just briefly about Eleanor Estes, she was born Eleanor Rosenfeld. So she was Jewish, but I don't think that she, at least her father was Jewish. I don't think that she stayed that persuasion. I think that she may have converted to Christianity just based on her books. But she grew up in West Haven, Connecticut, and in a lot of her books, The Moffats and any about the Pies, Ginger Pie, Pinkie Pie, those take place in a little town that she calls Cranberry, Connecticut. And it's based on the town where she grew up, West Haven, Connecticut, which is not terribly far from New Haven, which I think a lot more people are familiar with, New Haven, Connecticut. So, and The Moffats is sort of like All of a Kind Family is based on Sydney Taylor's childhood. The Moffats is based on Eleanor Estes's childhood. And so in the Moffat family, you've got the mother, their father had passed away. You've got Sylvie and Joe and Janie and Rufus. Janie is representative of Eleanor. So she doesn't give them, you know, their exact names or anything, but she does base so much of it on her childhood. So her father was a bookkeeper and told wonderful stories. Her mother was a seamstress, and she told stories to the children all the time, and anecdotes and things like that as she was preparing dinner and sewing and things. And so she like attributes her love of story and her ability to tell story to her mother, which I think is so sweet. Her father did die when she was quite young, and in the Moffats, their father had died. He's never a figure in any of the stories because he's already passed away. She was born in 1906. And the Moffats do take place in the early 20th century. Believe it's Rufus M. They talk about young men going away to World War I. Even in the Moffats, they talk about how there's like the place for army recruits to go sign up and things like that. So we're getting around the time of World War I. But Eleanor Estes starts writing in the 1940s. She married a guy who was also a librarian, and she was a librarian, and his last name was Estes. Rice Estes was his name. She came down with TB, with tuberculosis. And so when she was bedridden, she started writing, and she became a very prolific writer. Like, she wrote a ton of books, and so many of them won awards. Ginger Pie, it was distinguished with the Newbery Medal, but many others got like Newbery Honors and things like that. Ginger Pie, it's a wonderful book. And I think it's kind of, I could be wrong, but anybody who remembers like the Lord of the Rings trilogy knows that, like, I don't think the first two, like the Fellowship of the Ring and the Two Towers, I don't think they won very many Academy Awards. They won some, but then the Return of the King, the third one, it just like swept the Academy Awards. And in some ways, I think that that is sort of how Ginger Pie was. She's written so many incredible books. Ginger Pie is like the icing on the cake. And so we're going to give her the Newbery Medal, representative of all the books that she's written and how they're all just so good. But she also like did the illustrations for Ginger Pie.
I think the illustrations are a great addition to it. So my question is, what is your favorite of her books? if you can pick a very favorite.
I'm going to back up a little bit. She did start writing when she got tuberculosis and she was sort of bedridden. But I think I said that was in 1942. The Moffats was actually published in 1941. So it must have been just a little bit before that. But that was her first book. And she wrote for over 40 years. She died in 1988. Her last book, The Curious Adventures of Jimmy McGee, was published in 1987. So kind of amazing. But as far as my very favorite of all of her books, I don't know if I can choose. I love all the Moffats. They're so good. I would say the one that really stays with you is The Hundred Dresses. Is that one that you've read?
I have it. Okay. I haven't read it.
It's just excellent. Very, very good. I love all of them. I'm looking through like the list of all the books that she wrote and I'm like, well, I felt like we'd read a lot of them, but she has so many more that I hadn't really even heard of. I don't know that they're as readily available. I may have to look into some more.
Well, I'm enjoying this one. So good. Maybe today I'll read The Hundred Dresses. I have suddenly some time on my hands. Yeah, I was worried. I told you that at the beginning when I started reading it, I was worried we wouldn't have much to talk about, but I think I was wrong. So I was like, well, maybe we should have done it in two episodes, but I think there's plenty to talk about.
So chapter one gives us an introduction. And again, this is based on West Haven, Connecticut. So, but she calls it Cranberry. So I don't know if street names are the same or anything, but I think that so much of it she did based on her experience. So first she opens with the little girl who represents herself and her name is Janie. She talks about the little yellow house on New Dollar Street, which is where they live. And Janie, she is spending time with her mom, but then she goes outside and she just sits on this little stump and just thinks about how lucky they are to live on New Dollar Street, exactly in the precise location where they are, because you can see to the end of both sides. And she says that sometimes she and her siblings would just sit out there for hours because they could see the train going on one side and they could see what was happening on the other. And it was just kind of awesome. I do love this little phrase at the very beginning where she talks about her mother was peeling apples. It says a few turns of the knife and there the apple was all skinned. And Jane could not take her eyes from her mother's hands. They had a way of doing things, peeling apples, sprinkling salt, counting pennies, that fascinated her. And I love that so much. It's so sweet just watching her mother's hands. And I've thought about like how many times like I'll be peeling apples for like an apple pie or something. And after peeling hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of apples over the years, I've learned how to do it all in one time without the peel breaking, you know, and most people can do that, but my kids will come in and watch, how do you do that, mom? It's just so sweet, especially like from a child's perspective. And that's what I think is part of the brilliance of her authorship is how she gets into the mind of a child. And she makes this story, which takes place over 100 years ago, so very relatable that there's lots of times I have to go, well, this took place, like this was even written in a time that I don't completely understand. And it takes place well over 100 years ago. We can understand it today. And very applicable today, like so many of the things.
Yeah, these kids have like the same thoughts.
They totally do. Yeah. You're like, oh, I remember having those kinds of thoughts when I was a kid. Or I see my children having those kinds of thoughts or those kinds of behaviors. It's just so cute. Anyway, so as she's sitting there kind of just thinking about how they live in the most perfect place and she's observing some of the houses, and apparently at one point they had lived in this house across the street and then their father had passed away and so they'd had to move into the yellow house. I'm imagining the rent was quite a bit cheaper because they do rent their little house. And then there's like this brick lot and there's the house with Miss Squires, who's this grumpy old lady, and she decides that she wants to look at the world upside down. So she hangs upside down on this hitching post and looks at everything that way. And that's another one of those things. Like, don't kids just do that all the time? Like, you're like, okay, what you just did was so bizarre, but somewhere in your mind, it made total sense. And you're like, yeah, this is a good idea. And for Janie, she's like, I'm going to look at the world upside down. I'm going to hang upside down because everything looks different and fresh. She talks about how one of her neighbors, their house usually looks very run down. From upside down, it looks great. So that's awesome.
I read that part to Presley and I asked her, I'm like, do you ever do that? And she's like, yeah.
So cute. We do learn the names of everybody in her family. There's, of course, Mama, who is an incredible dressmaker, and that's how she's able to provide for her children, which is wonderful. And she's apparently like the most sought after, most skilled seamstress in all of Cranberry. So all the ladies come to her for their dresses. Of course, like she did have a sewing machine, but in the early 20th century, their sewing machines were pretty rudimentary. And like, not amazing, like what we have now. So she's just very hard worker. Papa had died when Janie was very young. And so in the family, there's Sylvie, who's the oldest sister. And I think that she's 15. And then there's Joey, the second, and then Janie and little Rufus, who is about 5 and a half. And Papa had died when Rufus was just a baby. So he'd been gone for probably at least 5 years. So as she's sitting there just upside down, this man comes along and he's like, is this where the Moffats live? And she says, well, yes. And so he goes right up to the house and he nails a sign to the house. And she's horrified to see that it's a for sale sign. And she's like, surely there's something wrong. She's like, the only time people put signs on the house is when there's like scarlet fever or something, which that's going to happen. I honestly don't remember if it's in this book or one of the other books, but we like, you learn all about how there's quarantines and things like that. And this period of time, it's very interesting. But so he puts a for sale sign on the house. She had no idea it was coming. Her brothers come down the street and she's like, look at this. And she's so upset. And then she's like, hey, Mama needs to see this because she's going to set it all right. And Mama comes out and sees it. She didn't know it was going to happen. Apparently they rent from a guy named Dr. Whitty. And she's like, did he tell you to put that on there? And the guy's like, yeah, I'm just following orders. So Mama goes and visits Dr. Whitty and comes back and is like, well, it's hard times. He just feels like he needs the money. So he's going to try to sell this house. The kids are just absolutely distraught. And Janie, she walks to the house and she walks to the living room and the kitchen, the spicy smelling kitchen and the warm parlor and the upstairs room and things like that. And she's just like, this can't happen. You know, I mean, that is essentially what happens here. They have this big issue right here at the beginning of the book and it's kind of looming through the book and Mama, she wishes they could buy it, but you know, she makes enough to provide for her children, but there's not much extra and certainly not enough to buy a house. So this is sort of this extra stress that the children are dealing with.
I think it's really like, that's a big thing for kids, you know, yeah. Even so my parents owned their house that we all grew up in. So, yeah. I mean, they built it a couple years before I was born and then we were all four born there and lived there. They sold it. I mean, we were all adults, but even as adults, it was still hard to like see the house go. So yeah. I can't imagine as a kid being like, oh, and why did he not tell the mother? Like,
yeah, I think it's one of those very different times, you know, like I said, there's so much in here that's just so relatable. You're like, oh, this could happen right now. But there's a lot of things too, that lets you know how times were at that point in history. And I think that's one of them. He had no obligation to tell them. And so he didn't. He's just like, yeah, go nail a for sale sign on that house.
I think
even though they'd been living there for 5 years.
Yeah, I think it was really cute how she just like marches off to him. She's like, what is going on? You have to tell me. This is upsetting. I don't know. I was just surprised that she didn't know. She's a woman. Maybe that's why.
Well, and that could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be. But speaking of that, she is quite the woman. She really is. She's a wonderful lady. And I love how throughout the book, whenever Mama shows up, whenever she's there or whenever they have trouble, they want her. They know that she can take care of things, that she's very capable and competent. And they're like, oh, Mama's here. It's going to be okay. It's really sweet. I love how you brought up that that's something that you felt as a, you know, when your parents sold their house.
Do your parents live in the house that you grew up in?
Okay. So that's something I was going to bring up. So there's a house that we moved into when I was probably, I just barely turned two when we moved into it. And then they sold it 2 years ago. They lived in it for a long time. So that is the house where I grew up. My blood, sweat, and tears went into the ridiculous yard and all the walls that surround it and the concrete that is everywhere and the retaining walls made of solid concrete. That's where I grew up. That was my neighborhood. I remember as a kid several times them talking about potentially selling it, you know, just if the market was just so or whatever. And they were like, oh, maybe we should sell. They actually put it up for sale a few times. And I was horrified. I was like, no, I don't want you to sell it. And I would just cry and cry, not to them, just like to myself. But it never did sell. And so, yeah, that's where we grew up. And that's what my kids have known, you know, as grandma and grandpa's house. And then just like 2.5 years ago, they sold it. And it's one of those things that when we're in that city, like my kids would be like, let's go drive by their old house. And it's kind of sad. That was a long time for them to have that. But
yeah, my parents owned their house for, I'm like 40 years. Well, like I'll drive by it and it just, it's like other people shouldn't be in there. It's our house that my dad built. It's just sad.
I know. You kind of feel like I should have a right to just go knock on the door and be like, hey, can I look around my house? But you don't have that right.
We've lived so many places that we just like, we'll say, oh, we lived down here when Katie was born. We lived here when so-and-so was born.
Yeah.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, that's same for us. So, oh, well, just different. Was there anything that as a child you watched your mom do that you were like, I could never do that as well? Or that is so amazing. And you're just like going back to the apples. So Janie is watching her mom peel this apple. And she's like, I could never do that, you know? So just watching an adult do something that you just were in admiration of. And you were like, I don't know. Could I ever do that? It doesn't have to necessarily be your mom.
Her handwriting was always like the same and perfect. Mine never has been. My handwriting changes. I don't know what, how, or why. But like, even today, I'm like, how do you write the same all the time?
That is really funny because that's the exact same with my mom. Like, she has excellent handwriting. And it is. It's always the exact. You could pick it out of anywhere. Like, that's her handwriting because it's nice and it's neat and it is always consistent.
If you're listening with kids, just trigger warning here about Christmas things, but we always knew. I mean, I was like, Mom, Santa's handwriting is exactly like you couldn't, she couldn't hide her handwriting if she tried. And she did try.
That's really funny.
Because she would change it enough that, like, but I was like, it's totally her handwriting. Nowadays, we have computers for that, but
I know, right?
It's always consistent. And like my handwriting changes with my mood.
Yeah. Or like how tired you are, or how tired your hand is, or do I feel like writing in print or in cursive? And that cursive looks great. And that cursive looks like it was a 3-year-old who did it, but totally the same.
The other thing is watching my grandma knit. She taught me how to crochet and I could crochet, but I could never knit and I still can't. And I don't know if it's because I'm left-handed. I don't think that's the problem. She used to blame that as the problem. She used to say, I think it's because you're left-handed and you can't see what I'm doing. And I'm like, no, I think it's because there's no hook on the end of the knitting needle. Like to hold it on.
Yeah.
But I cannot knit. And so I'd watch her go to town and I was like, I don't know how you do that. That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. No, that's a really good example. And speaking of knitting, I love how it talks about how Janie, she just wants to go climb an apple tree and just knit. And that was something too, as I was like a few little things in this chapter that stood out to me was like how she talked about how she wanted to get up in the tree and just knit and how sometimes she and her siblings would just sit on the hitching poster around in their front yard and just watch the street for hours. And I thought, I think our children would be so much healthier if that was one of their options. Like, you know, I mean, obviously it is an option. It's not an option they're going to take, but in this period of time, they're helping around the house. They're going to school. They're running their errands for their mom, or they're just being creative and they're just people watching the world and learning a lot of things that way for hours at a time. It's amazing.
If our kids could just be a little more bored.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Totally.
Did you answer the question? Is there anything you watched your parents do or other people do that you were amazed by?
I think most things, especially like, anything to do with cooking. I was like, I don't know if I could ever do that. I don't know if I just have this weird mental issue, but there's so many things that I'm like, I don't think I could ever do that. But then you patiently work away at it. You go, oh, actually I can. That's kind of magical. Driving stick shift. had a stick shift car when I was really young. I was like, how does that even work? You know, and my dad would just do it very seamlessly, obviously. And then I learned to drive a stick shift. And I was really like, I don't think I'm ever actually going to be able to do this. But just patiently, day after day, little by little, you learn to do it. Can really learn to do just about anything, I think, with patience and time and effort.
You don't realize as a child your dexterity and your like muscles will grow and you'll just, things will be easier when you get older. You know, we might buy a gingerbread house and have Presley do it. And she does pretty dang good, but like sometimes you just don't know what a little kid can and can't do.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you'll give them a task or something or a project and you'll be like, oh, this is like above their capabilities, you know?
Yes.
They don't realize that as they grow, it's going to get way easier.
Yeah. And sometimes as a parent, I have a hard time going, okay, are they, you know, they will learn how to do this, instead of going, are they ever going to learn?
Yeah. So. Like cleaning or sweeping or just all those little things that they just don't have the, I don't know what it is. It's like the coordination to do, or.
Yeah. A lot of it's coordination. A lot of it is just like awareness. I'm like, you thought that you had swept in here? Why did you think that? Really? But I think it's really, they're like, oh yeah, I totally swept. Just because you got a pile out of here doesn't mean that it's completely swept yet. How would you look at this floor and think, oh yeah, that looks good. Oh, but.
Okay. I thought this chapter was so cute. This is the one I was like, oh, there's not much to talk about. And then I was like, oh, there's a lot. So it's called June and the Chief of Police. You've got railroad tracks at one end of New Dollar Street, which is where they live. And then the chief of police's house, who's Chief Mulligan, is at the other end of the street. And the little yellow house is like right in the middle. Like you said, they can see both sides. Chief Mulligan's yard is like perfectly tended. Like it's like perfect. And so Jane's always really careful when she's in front of his house. And she says that she would never want him to think that she's running away from her latest crime. Like she's very afraid of him. She's afraid he's going to arrest her. And she's also tries to get her family to be like very careful around his house. Like he's scary to her. What I thought was funny is she's constantly overthinking her interactions with him. She decided that the best thing to do would be like this casual nod as he's going by, because she'd seen her mom do it to other people. And so she's doing that one day and Rufus sees her doing this and he asks her why, for goodness sakes, she was bobbing her head around in that foolish fashion and making faces at the chief of police. And I just wanted to laugh, like hysterically thinking like, when I was a kid, I have some things I've said to strangers that I will never forget that I said, because it was like the stupidest thing ever. And you walk away and you're like, why did I say that? And they must have thought I was totally crazy, you know?
Yeah.
She must have looked crazy, like bobbing her head. And like,
yeah.
Rufus is like, what are you even doing?
Because again, it's like things that make sense in the head of a child, somehow they just make sense to them, but they don't actually compute in real life.
Yeah. It just,
to them, it's like the end of the world, or, you know?
Yeah. So luckily the chief of police did not even notice her. She was doing this strange bobbing of her head. But one day when she's outside, this like important looking man walks by. Well, she's just first happy that he's not there to look at the house.
In fact, she stands up and like blocks the for sales.
Yes. Don't look. And he says to her, how do you do, little girl? And then she thinks he must know her. But then she realizes that he's like saying the same things to everybody that is. It goes down the street. And so she starts following him down the street and she's imitating his walk, which is his stomach is stuck out. He's nodding his head to the left and the right, I'm like, that's strange. It reminds me of like lifeguards at a pool where they're like, they do this weird thing with their head where they're looking left and right.
Yeah.
The guy has no idea that she's behind him. And she is really proud of how she's mastered his walk. And she's so excited to go home. And like at dinner time, she's going to show everybody at the house this walk and they're going to think she's hilarious. Now, did they mention Peter Frost in the beginning, in the first chapter?
Yes, it's his house that usually looks pretty run down and ragged, but when you're looking at it from upside down, then okay, it looks just fine. But he is sort of the neighborhood, just annoying kid. I don't know if you could like full on call him a bully, but he's just irritating.
He's like on the middle, the family down the street that like Brooke Shields is their mother. And they're just like dirty and like mean and awful. It's very funny. She mentioned him a couple of times after this. And I was like, did they mention him in the first one? But he comes along and he whispers to her, you know, the guy in front of her has no idea she's back there. And he whispers to her, you can be arrested for that. He's like, don't you know who that is? That's Mr. Penny Popper. And he's the new superintendent of schools. And so then it says that Peter sounds his siren right in her ear. So is that like on his, he must have, maybe it's like one of those squeezy.
His little bike. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So she runs off towards home. The man stops. He plugs his ears and he looks around and she's gone. And so he just keeps on walking. But when she gets home, she hides in this lilac bush that has this like little hole in it for her to sit in. And she's worried about getting arrested and going to jail. And she wishes that she could go tell her mom and then her mom would make her feel better about it. But then she's like, well, she's busy. She's cutting out a dress and we're not supposed to bother her when she's doing that. And then Joe, her older brother, comes and finds her and says that he needs her to go to the store to get some sugar. So he leaves her a quarter. And I thought this was funny too, because she's like, well, why don't you go? And he's like, well, I'm going to ride my bike. And so he just takes off. And I'm thinking, now, did they really ask her to get the sugar, or was he supposed to? So
excellent question.
I don't know. They didn't say. She's relieved that the store is at the opposite end of Dollar Street from Mr. Mulligan's house, because she's worried about this getting arrested thing. And so she starts off towards the store and the day is so pleasant. She forgets about all of the things she was worried about. The sun is out. She gets to the store and she has this little conversation with Mr. Bruni, the storekeeper, about his potato salad. And he's like, I'm not giving you my recipe, but here's a lollipop. So she starts sucking on the lollipop, goes outside. And then she sees Chief Mulligan coming up to this, like he's going to walk by the store. And so she jumps into this bread box, which is a box that's outside for the baker to drop off his loaves of bread in the morning. Yeah. So it must be a pretty big box because she fits in it. And then later we find out that there was 14 loaves of bread in there. So it's pretty big. Because I was thinking of a bread box. Like my mom used to have a bread box on her counter. Yeah. One or two loaves would fit in it. She jumps into the bread box in front of the store. And just as she thinks that Chief Mulligan, she's listening for his footsteps, just as she thinks he's far enough away, she peeks out and Mr. Bruni has come out to sweep. And he sweeps and he sweeps and he sweeps. And she kind of thinks at first, like, well, I like him. Maybe I'll get out. But then he's going to wonder why I'm in the bread box. It's going to be awkward. So she's waiting and waiting and waiting. And then she decides she's going to count to 50 and then she'll jump out. And then just as she gets to 50, Mrs. Shoemaker comes. And Mr. Shoemaker apparently is the gossip or the talker of the town. And she reminds me of in Anne of Green Gables, Mrs. Lynde.
Yeah, Rachel Lynde. Yes.
So she's like, well, I don't want to jump out now because she's the worst person to like show up here. And then she sits on the bread box so she could get out if she wanted to. And I just thought that was funny. Like this lady has time to sit on the bread box and like swing her feet and kick the bread box and shoot the breeze with Mr. Bruni.
Just chat. Yeah.
It's just, it was funny. So she's in the box for so long that she falls asleep. And she dreams about this black horse that comes to rescue her. And Mr. Bruni and Mrs. Shoemaker and Chief Mulligan are on their own horses. And they're chasing her. And then she ends up in this beautiful clearing in the forest. And like they get a drink out of this, what is it, like a brook or something. And then she wakes up. At the end of her dream, she's waiting for her white prince. So cute. And then she wakes up and she's hearing Chief Mulligan saying that Jane Moffat's been missing for 2 to 3 hours. Like, we don't know where she is. And Mr. Bruni's like, well, I saw her earlier. And then he's like, gets distracted because he sees the baker coming. And he's like, wait, I have to go talk to the baker because he didn't leave enough loaves of bread. He charged me for 14, but he only left 13. And I just thought that was kind of funny. Like, we have a missing child. And like,
I know. But I'm worried about the bread. Yes. That one loaf.
Luckily, we're worried about the bread because that's how I find her. But
yes,
the chief of police is like kind of interested in this conversation. He's like, okay, well, let's look and see. So he gets his flashlight out. He opens up the bread box and he's like, whoa, is this your missing loaf of bread? And he's like, lifts Jane out. Then he just carries her home. And when she tells him, he's like, well, what were you hiding from? And she's like, well, I was hiding from you. she explains why, and he just kind of talks to her about how there's no reason to be afraid of policemen. We're here to help you. It's just kind of a cute little conversation.
It
And
is.
She says at the end, like, she's still careful when she's around his house, but like from now on, she's not afraid of him.
They have a good relationship. Yeah. It's so cute because just the fact that she does, she opens up and tells him the entire story, and he just about dies laughing. Tears are squeezing out of his eyes because he is just laughing so hard. And she's like, oh, he's actually pretty nice.
That reminds me of, I went to my great uncle's, not my great uncle, my uncle. It seems like he should be my great uncle. My uncle's 84th birthday party last week.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And my cousin Adam was there. And I remember being a little kid and he went into the army or something. And so like he came home from the army and his head was shaved. And like, I was totally scared of him. I don't know why no hair scared me, but like he was different. And I don't, anyways, it just kind of reminded me like, did you have any irrational fears growing up?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of irrational fears, but I remember when I, just a little kid, my older sister would tell me all these things and I just believe them as absolute truth. So at this point in time, when I was little, I don't know, there was just this fear that the Russians were going to attack at any moment. Did you have that at all? I mean, it was like the 80s and I don't know, like everybody's scared of the Russians. I think my parents were like, maybe a little bit, maybe just some things they'd talked about from their childhood, like during the Cold War and things, whatever. But so my sister was like, if you see a sign has fallen down, that means the Russians are coming. And so I would see like a for sale sign had like fallen down or something. I was like, oh my gosh, it's time. Like it's going to happen. They're coming around the bend any minute, you know? And I had this specific idea of how it would look when the Russians invade. And this is like nothing against Russians. This is just like what my horrible fear was, like coming around the corner. So I just imagine them just like marching shoulder to shoulder along River Road in St. George, you know, coming to get us, of course, completely ignoring every other person in house. And that just makes so much sense. And then she also told me, when you see a crack in the road, that means there's going to be an earthquake. And I was absolutely terrified of earthquakes. And there was actually a really bad one when I was about 8 years old in St. George that like rocked I was sleeping on the top bunk bed and it like rocked the bunk bed and everything. But of course, there's cracks in every road all over the place. So I was terrified.
I didn't like cracks. Like my dad was a plasterer. And so like there would be cracks. The plaster would crack. The house would creak too. Like you could hear it like settling.
Yeah.
And that scared me to death. And my dad was always it's fine. It's fine. It's just, you know, but like you could see in the corner of your room, like a crack up in the plaster. And that just scared me. I don't know. I was afraid of ghosts. I would lay in bed at night and like my mom believed in ghosts and that did not help.
Oh no, that doesn't help.
No. And so I would lay in bed and like worry that they were coming to get me. Or I was also worried about Diane Downs, who was like in Oregon. She killed her three kids. Well, she didn't kill her three kids. I think one of them died and she shot them. And I was like determined that she was going to come get us. Like the same thing with the Russians. Like she's going to come into our house and take us. Like, no, she just wanted to get rid of her own kids. I was like so afraid of her and just crazy. And then Sydney told me last night that she'd spent the night at somebody's house and the daughter, her friend wanted to sleep in the living room, but the dad was watching like some scary movie and like these zombies were eating somebody's toes. And she said she couldn't sleep for years after that because she would just think about that, like the zombies
about zombies eating your toes. I mean, fair enough. Yeah, not scary.
I know. She said, I didn't like to go to sleep because I was alone with my own thoughts. I'm like, that's so sad. And why did you not tell us? And then I was like,
but as a kid, you probably feel like, okay, but this, you know, just kind of like her going, I'd love to go tell mama, but she said to not interrupt her when I'm, you know, when she's cutting out material. And it's like, okay, this would be fine to go talk to her about. But in her little mind, she was like, no, I can't do that.
Or she was like, in the daytime, it's irrational. So like if I was to tell my mom I was afraid of this, she'd be like, that's ridiculous. But then at nighttime, it like becomes, your thoughts make it like real.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, later on, we learned like things about the family. They lived next door to us and we're like, well, probably shouldn't let the kids sleep over there, and we didn't for the last like couple of years they live there. And then I was like, we probably shouldn't have let them sleep over there ever. Obviously,
Oh,
when you know better, you do better. That's what David said last
yeah,
night.
totally. I mean, like, you don't know, a lot of times you don't know what you don't know. You're just doing the best you can. So I just love the little insights we get into, like I said, sort of life in the early 20th century. Like this little store with this guy, he's like homemaking the potato salad that he's going to sell. And I just imagine like walking into the store and like the clean floor and all these smells and you know, it's just very personal and sweet, and I don't know, and simple. I love it.
I like the way she words things in here too. Like it's just
Yeah,
a sweet,
she's so
like,
good.
way of writing.
Yeah, since you brought that up, I don't remember if you said this or not, but after Peter Frost is like, you can be arrested for that, you know, when she's copying Mr. Penny Pepper, and she's like, what's gonna happen to me? Oh, yeah, what would her punishment be? She wondered. Jail, obviously. I don't know. It's just so funny. Like, again, just the mind of a child. Obviously, I'm going to jail. Oh my gosh.
Mocking somebody like for
Yeah. But small things seem very, very big for little kids. So,
yes. Oh my gosh. Yesterday, Presley, she has this fear of her teeth being loose
okay.
or losing teeth or whatever. It's just bizarre. And so she comes into my room, and I mean, I have COVID, so she's not supposed to come into my room. It's I like this is the only thing I'm safe to do right now because I'm in my office and you're in Utah.
Yeah.
David's like, you're gonna record? I'm like, yeah, it's like the only thing I don't have to cancel. So she comes into my room. She's like, I think my tooth is loose. And I'm like, it's fine. Okay, well, I can't put my finger in your mouth right now. So I
Yeah.
don't know. Anyways, I'm like, are you sure? And she's like, yeah. And she goes back in. She comes back and she's like, no, it's not loose. She goes, but can I have a friend over so I can forget about it? And I was like, well, first of all, no, because I have COVID. But second of all, you need to forget about the fact that you thought your tooth was loose for like 20 seconds.
So funny. I love it. And like totally, oh, the logic. It's great.
Like, I mean, she just made this tiny little thing and she thought her tooth was loose for a few seconds and now she needs a friend over so she can forget about
She can forget about it. It was a rough 20 seconds, okay? Like, jeez.
It's
That's
true.
so funny. Chapter 3 is called The First Day of School, and it's so funny. So it's the start of school for everybody, but it's specifically the very first day of school for little Rufus. And evidently they start school as first graders and he's 5 and a half. And so I was trying to think, like, that's when kids start kindergarten now, right? It's when they're 5 and they turn 6 in kindergarten. But yeah, he's in the first grade. And so they're heading along and they run into their friends, the Pudges, and Chet Pudge is Joey's friend. And then there's this little boy, Huey Pudge. He does not want to go. And it's so funny because apparently the year before he was supposed to start in the first grade at the school. And he put up such a fuss that his mom was like, well, you can stay home for one day. And then he ended up just staying home the entire year. And so, which, yeah, that in itself is just really funny. But now his mom's like, no, like you have to go to school or you're going to grow up to be a dunce. And he just won't do it. He's just putting up such a fight. The little Moffat children are trying to convince him to go. And finally, Mr. Pennypepper, this superintendent of schools, he comes along. He's like, what's going on? Finds out he doesn't want to go. And so he just is like, well, that's what we're doing today. We're all going to school. And which I think is a really good way to deal with children a lot of times. Like, well, this is what we're doing. The end. And he just grabbed his arm. He grabbed Rufus's arm, and then Janie grabbed Rufus's arm. So they're all like linked together and they head to the schoolyard. He drops them off in the boys' schoolyard, and then the girls go over to the girls' schoolyard. I think that's interesting. And I wish I'd had a little more time this week because I wanted to kind of do a deep dive into that and like how are schools set up and why is there a girls' yard and a
Yeah.
boys' yard, and because they all are in the same class, they're not separated when they're in class, but apparently during recess and when they first come to school, they have different areas where they hang out together. They don't mingle. So anyway, they do make it into class, and Rufus really likes his teacher, Miss Andrews, and he opens up this book with it that's it's all shiny and has all these letters and pictures, and he's like, "How am I ever going to read that?" Which kind of goes back to what we talked about before, just like these overwhelming, almost seemingly insurmountable things that we look at as kids and we're like, I don't think I can ever do that. And then we do. Right in the middle of the lesson, the kids look up and they see little Huey is leaving the classroom. And at this point, most of them, this is, they're maybe the oldest in their family. And so they're just like, oh, okay, he's leaving. I guess that's what we can do. None of them were trying to leave, but Rufus is like, since he's got older siblings and he kind of knows how things are supposed to be, he's like, he's not supposed to do that. And also kind of an important note that I should have mentioned earlier is that as he was dropping them off, Mr. Pennypepper whispered to Rufus and he's like, you make sure that, you know, Huey comes to school and that he stays in school today. Right. Which was, I'm sure that was, it was well-intentioned and well-meant, but I don't think he realized how much sort of inappropriate responsibility he put on a little 5-year-old. Yeah. Like, because Rufus is a kid who takes everything very seriously. He's like, well, Mr. Pennypepper told me that I need to help him stay at school. So he feels this responsibility when Huey leaves. And so they are supposed to get up and go out to recess after a time. And I love this. It's sort of like they're little soldiers. Miss Andrews is like, class, stand. They didn't do it quite right. So she has them sit down and they do it again until they do it right. And then they have to march out. But as soon as they get out to the schoolyard, Rufus takes off because he sees where Huey went. Well, the schoolyard is not very far from the railway station. And Huey had gone down to this rail car. So Rufus follows him down there and he finds him inside the car. He climbs up there and they just sit there. And it seems like it's just off to the side, like not being used or anything. It's not on the main tracks. And so he's like, no, like we need to go back to school. And Huey's like, no, I'm just going to sit here and watch the trains. Maybe I'll take one. Rufus doesn't want to stay there. He's like, if I stay here, I might miss something important in school. Maybe they're going to learn how to read without me, you know? But he feels, like I said, all this responsibility to Huey, like, because Mr. Pennypepper told him he needed to take care of him. So he stays with him. And after a while, they hear this choo choo and this little engine that's not carrying anything else. It backs up and hooks up to this car that they're sitting on and they start moving. I love how whenever something starts going awry, the first thing that they think about is their mom. She's going to be, what if we get lost? She's going to be worried. But then he thinks, okay, if, you know, if this train takes us to Boston, we get lost. My name is Rufus Moffat. I live on 27 New Dollar Street and I'm 5 and a half. He starts repeating this to himself. He's like, this is what mama told me to do if I ever got lost. And then after that, his concerns sort of wear away and he just like starts to enjoy the ride. Well, they go get all the way to New Haven. And this is where their stop is. And or the first stop for this little train. And the engineer, he jumps off and he sees these two boys. He's like, what are you doing here? And they're like, basically, oh, he says, whoa, 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 what's this? Where'd you come from? Rufus Moffat, 27 New Dollar Street, 5 and a half years old. Huey and me have to get back to school. And so the man is actually really sweet. And he's like trying to figure out how to get them back to Cranberry. So he goes to this express train that is supposed to go straight through to New York, no stops. And he goes and talks to the conductor and the engineer. And they're like, no, we can't stop in Cranberry. That's not going to work. But Bob, who's their engineer, who is driving the train they came on, he goes and talks to the station master and they get special permission to stop in Cranberry for 30 seconds to drop these boys off. So they jump on this express train, which moves really, really, really fast, like faster than they could imagine. And they're right there with the engineer. And I think the guy who like scoops the coal and stuff, they stop in Cranberry. They basically like just lift the boys out. Okay, see ya. And they're like, well, everybody on the train is like, why are we stopping here? But it's really sweet. All these good people who are like watching out for him. So they run back to school and Huey does say, he's like, do you have to go to school to be an engineer? And Rufus is like, well, yeah, of course you do. That engineer named Dick. Well, once he was in room 1-2 and Huey's like, well, then I guess I'll go to school. And so they did, went back to school.
And like, so, that's it.
Yeah.
But he said, like, where the heck were you guys?
I know. They're just like, okay. Yeah.
The teacher didn't notice that Huey left. So maybe she didn't notice they weren't there.
Yeah. And that's I mean, maybe it's one of those things. It was the first day of school. So all of the, she's not going to necessarily notice who's not there because she doesn't know their faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was so cute and so funny. So the question is, have you ever been in a pickle like that you're like, what are we going to do? I think I'm lost forever. Or, I mean, not necessarily lost forever, but just like in a big pickle that you weren't sure how you're going to get out of. And it was completely just one thing led to another, and all of a sudden it's happening.
When David and I were engaged, we were driving my mom's motor home from Oregon to Utah. My mom was with us, but she was in the back, and we had like some teenage girls with us in the back, like my sister and a couple of her friends were in the back. And David and I were like just driving along, and this is, in like 1999, so we didn't have GPS. And we're just driving along, and one of the teenage girls looks out the window and says, "This doesn't look right." It didn't look like the right kind of trees or something. And David and I were like, "Oh my gosh, we forgot to turn and bend." Like, we just kept going. And it was probably like 2 hours ago that we should have turned. And so we didn't know what to do. We didn't have GPS. We called David's dad and we're like, "Do what should we do?" And he's like, "Well, just keep going. You can go through this town and this town. You can come up through Nevada or whatever." And so we did. We should have turned around and went back to Bend, but it was like a 24-hour drive from Eugene to Provo. It was horrible. And we were in a huge motor home on like cliffs,
Oh my
like
gosh,
driving
terrifying.
through California and Nevada. That's the only thing I can think of is that we were like, "Well, now what?" Whoops. So.
As far as getting lost, I have lots of getting lost stories because I just like GPS on my phone has been the biggest blessing because before that, I just spent a lot of time being lost. Because I did something similar when I first drove my kids from, I think from Portland, when we lived in Portland, down to Utah. I don't even know how it happened, but I think I took a wrong turn at Burns because we ended up headed almost to Winnemucca in Nevada.
Well, that's where we went.
Okay, that's kind of what I was wondering. Like, so maybe it's Ben. I thought it was Burns. And because to this day, I'm like, I don't even know how we ended up on that road. Like, I really don't. But after a while, I'm like, this does not seem right. Yeah.
Least you're
Anyway,
able to correct it.
I did turn all the way around and go all the way back. And I'm pretty sure we ended up being in Burns. It was just, but yeah, much longer trip than what we wanted. And my big, like, I was terrified we're going to run out of gas because there's not much.
No.
There's not much. Another time, though, that there was really, as far as like being lost, I grew up in St. George, which is a pretty small town, especially when I was growing up, it's pretty small. And then we moved to Portland, much larger city, right? I had taken my kids downtown to Portland. We'd gone to like Powell's bookstore and like the food carts and things like that. And then we needed to get home. And it was starting to get dark and my phone died. I was not familiar at all with all the twists and turns and how to get from the middle of Portland on the road because we actually lived in Gresham. So it's a bit of a drive from the middle of Portland out to Gresham because it wasn't even like Gresham right by Portland. It was like Gresham right by Troutdale, which is like on the edge of the Columbia. I mean, it's Columbia River Highway. We're like not that far from like Multnomah Falls. And I had no idea how to get there. And my phone died. It was starting to get dark. I don't see very well in the dark. And I was terrified. And there's all these bridges, and I kept like crossing bridges and like circling around. I was like, okay, had to just like stop a minute and breathe and go, all right, well, what direction are we needing to go? We've got to go east. So
But
I need to.
you can't see Mount
No,
Hood.
you can't.
That's
It was
funny.
really scary. I eventually figured it out, but
The bridges in Portland are like a maze, and
there's
it's
such a
like,
maze. Yeah.
yeah.
And there's so much traffic and there's all these signs that are pretty confusing. There's all these like one-way roads, and that is scary because I don't know. And what is the entrance for this that is going to lead me to the entrance for that anyway?
One time when I was a little kid, my mom was lost in Portland, and we kept going on all these bridges. And she said to me, "Laura, have you ever seen this place before?" And I said, "Yeah, once when we were lost."
that.
Yeah, my grandma lived downtown Portland, and I just remember just going over those bridges like all the time. And now I drive them all the
Yeah.
time, but sometimes even with the GPS, I'm like, what does the GPS want me to do? Does it want me to go left? Does it
I
want me to go
know.
right? Like, I don't know. And then you make a choice and you're like, well, I was wrong.
That's probably the wrong. I know, because you have like this split second decision
Yes.
a lot of times, and it's like it's not very clear because the traffic and the road signs and turns are pretty
Yes.
confusing, honestly. I don't think that they're very straightforward, so.
Yeah, I'm like trying to see if it's fork, if you're supposed to take the left, and is it match what the sign says? And like, I'm trying to not get in an accident. And at times it's like panic.
Oh,
But
yeah, for sure.
if I was a little kid and got stuck on a railroad car and was leaving, I cannot imagine. And they were just kind of like, this is fun. I don't know. They
Yeah,
weren't like
no.
that, but scary.
They were like 5, 6. So at that point, maybe just didn't know enough to be scared. I mean, Rufus was a little scared, but
And maybe nowadays our parents have scared the heck out of us. So, like,
maybe so.
they weren't so scared because
Yeah.
they seem all through this book like people will help them. Like,
Yeah.
nowadays, if we got lost, we'd be afraid that somebody would kidnap us or.
I know.
So, chapter four is A Horse and a Wagon, which this chapter reminded me of The Wheel on the School. Kind of like a little adventure that they go on, like
Yeah.
with the wagon and everything. And I just thought it was so cute. It's very funny. I read a review about it that said like that the lady that read it was bored and she thought it was just so boring and so awful. And I was like, I kind of think it's funny.
Are you serious? She
Yes.
said that about, I don't think I could ever take her seriously about anything.
She said something like, well, Ginger Pie was good, but like I really didn't like this book. But I disagree. I thought this chapter was hilarious. And it makes me wonder, like, how much of this she made up and how much of, I mean, she had to have made this one up. We'll get into it, but I don't see how this could happen. So, and this is interesting. I don't know if Jewish people have Sunday school, but all the kids are responsible for getting themselves ready for Sunday school. And I thought that was kind of funny.
Well,
So,
that's the reason that I'm wondering if she may have converted to Christianity,
like as a
because
child, like our parent mom
that's,
did.
or maybe her parents already were, just
Yeah.
because they wouldn't have Sunday school,
No.
certainly.
And Rufus, who's the youngest, has a hard time with this, like getting himself ready and then being bored. Like everybody else has things they can study and he has nothing to do. And so he gets ready and then he's bored. And I liked this. He says, this was not allowed and that was not allowed. He's irritated by all these rules on Sunday, which I can agree that as a
Yeah,
child,
yeah.
it's really hard when your mom's like, we weren't allowed to watch TV and we weren't allowed to, run and play. Oh. So he gathers the grapes in the backyard that had fallen through the night from the wind and the rain. And he said, and this is another reference to Peter Frost, in case he saw Peter Frost and then he could chuck them at him.
I know.
So he must be a problem because
Yeah.
they all seem to have dislike for him. This reminded me of Audrey. Jane is having a hard time with her duty to her neighbor memorization that she's supposed to be doing, but Rufus already knew it. Like he'd heard her say it so many times that he could say it better than her. And then he'd done the same thing when Sylvie was learning Latin and when Joe was learning history. So he must be super, super smart. Like he's the youngest and he's like picking up on all these things that the older kids are learning. So it just reminded me of
Yes.
Audrey.
Yes, that, and also I think that a lot of times we underestimate what the children can actually comprehend and what
Yeah.
is going into their minds. Like, and that's why I always, even when my kids are really little, I have them sit in on what we're doing in our school and our books and things like that, because I remember like the kids, I had the older kids like memorizing a poem or something like that. And Audrey was just little, my Audrey too. Yeah. Same as your Audrey. She was maybe like 2 or 3. And I was having everybody like recite the poem, and she raised her hand and she wanted to do it, and just rattled it off. Like, I think better than anybody, because she'd really been tuning in and listening the whole time. So yeah, I think it's awesome. They can
Yeah, that's
totally
just
pick up
so
on things.
cute. He knew it better than she did. The grapes that he had picked were now squashed in his suit. So, like, this is his best suit that he's wearing. And so he has to go change it for his next best suit. After he changes his clothes, then he's sitting out on the hitching post waiting for the others to get ready. And then Peter Frost comes by on his bike. And he kind of approaches slowly, and then he sounds his siren. So this must be like a habit of his. And
Yes.
Rufus
It's
then
annoying.
falls off the hitching post, and now he has to go change his suit again. So now he's wearing like his regular old suit. He's soiled the other two. And Mama is not happy, but the girls like convince her that it was not his fault. Sylvie runs off to meet her friend Edie, and then the kids are outside, and a slow-moving horse and wagon are coming up on them. And the man driving the wagon asks which way he needs to go to Orchard Grove. And so Joe, he negotiates a ride on the wagon. He's like, "Hey, if you'll let us ride on the wagon, I will show you which way to go." So he gets in the wagon and he hands Joe the reins, and he's like, "I'm gonna go take a nap." And Joe's like, "Okay."
What in the world?
He's
Yeah.
like, "I've never driven a wagon before, but all right, this doesn't look so hard." And so he says, "When you need to wake me up, just beat on this drum, because it's really the only thing that's going to wake me up."
It's a very deep sleeper.
Yes. And so when they get to Sunday school, where they're supposed to get off, the man is still sleeping and they don't want to go to Sunday school. So they decide that they're going to drive him all the way to Orchard Grove. So they leave Sylvie a note in chalk on the trough there that I can't remember what the note says. It's like, "We're getting
So
wiped
it
out."
just says, "Sylvie, we have gone with the Salvation Army, Joe, Jane, Rufus." And they do it with a piece of white chalk that, of
Yes.
course, Joey has in his pocket, like any kid would.
Yeah, like yeah.
Oh.
So they leave this in chalk, which is clearly not very permanent, and the man is still sleeping. So they start climbing up Shingle Hill, which is very steep. And Rufus and Jane are like having to really hold on to stay in the wagon because the hill is so steep. So Joe tells them that if it gets too steep, they're going to have to jump out and put a rock under the wheels so that they don't slide back down. Now, this is another situation where I would have been like, "This is not something we should have done. This is scary." But
Yeah.
luckily the horse is like strong enough and he doesn't ever stop, and they make it up the hill. But they decide while they're driving that the Salvation Army man is either a minister or he's a captain. And he still hasn't woken up. So they use they're upset that he's sleeping up front. They kind of want him to sleep in the back so that they can all sit up front. And so they use the drum, which works. And so he jumps out of his seat up onto the ground and he starts waving his arms and talking like he's in a panic, I think. And then he figures out, like, okay, he kind of wakes up a little bit and he's like, "I know where I am now, but where are we?" And then the kids tell him that Orchard Grove is just a couple of miles away and that they're going to take him there. And they ask him if he'd rather sleep in the back because they all want to sit in the front. And he says, "Yeah, I'd rather go in the back and sleep." And so he goes back there and he just goes back to sleep immediately. Then they, of course, come upon a sign that says the road is closed and that they need to take a detour, right? But it doesn't tell them where the roads are going, like which
Yeah.
road's going to take us where. They just choose the lower road. As soon as they do that, their back wheel gets stuck in a ditch. And then they finally, like, the wheel is spinning on its own. I think it's not moving. And then they finally get it to go because by the wagon lurches forward, but they don't notice that the Salvation Army man is thrown from the wagon. Of course, this wakes him up, right? And so he's calling to them, but they don't hear him. This is why I think this could not have happened. They also don't notice that the weather is changing, but the horse notices. So they're like clouds, and the horse twitches his ears, and then they hear a clap of thunder, and the horse like rears up its hind legs. And just when they think that Orchard Grove is just around the corner, they come up on Elm Street, which is like home.
Yeah, they have gone in a circle.
Once the rain lets up, they decide to take the shore road because the other roads are going to be in awful condition. And they still think that the man is in the back of the wagon. So they're headed back to the green, thinking about how much they would rather just be at home eating Sunday dinner, but they're starving. And their mom must have just been like sending them to Sunday school. She obviously wasn't going. She was staying home and like getting things
Making
ready for
dinner.
dinner. Yeah.
Well, because I think the Sunday school part was for the kids, and then the adults went later for
Later.
like the whole meeting or something. Yeah.
So, well, that at that point somebody says, like, Well, I haven't heard the captain snoring in quite a while. And they're like, well, I mean, people don't snore constantly. And like, this guy has been. He was snoring the whole time and we haven't heard
Yeah.
him. So Joe was like, well, he has to still be there. They hadn't heard him get out. And I liked this. First, they had lost the road. Now they'd lost the captain. And while they were trying to decide what to do, they were like, well, which way should we go? Should we go backwards the way we came, or should we start over and go again to look for him? Like, and Mrs. Shoemaker is sitting there listening in on their conversation, and she keeps saying, well, I never.
I know. She is gathering gossip.
Yes. Then they realize that the only words left on the message that they left for Sylvie with chalk because of the rain says Army and Joe. So Sylvie comes running across the street saying that their mom wants them to come home and wondering what they'd meant by army. Like they just left the word army. And she thinks that it had something to do with a poster at the town hall that says, join the army, enlist. I was like, did she think that they'd like enlisted and
All
left?
these little kids.
Yeah. And so then all these people are coming around and like the kids are feeling super important because they're like the center of attention. Their mom comes out and she says, well, why don't you guys come home and eat? Mrs. Shoemaker notices there's this like soaking wet man coming towards them. And the kids say, it would have been better if he hadn't gotten out of the wagon. They say that to him, like, why did you get out of the wagon? And he says, I was thrown out. And you guys didn't hear me. Like I was calling for you and you didn't hear me. So then Mama just invites everybody over for dinner. Mrs. Shoemaker says that she can't go because they always spend the afternoon in the cemetery. Interesting.
It's like, okay, again, like different times. All
Yes,
right.
like, well, me and my friend, we spend every after Sunday afternoon in the cemetery. Okay. And then
So
so they just
restful.
that's what she does say. It's so restful, quiet there. I just wonder like if she was if her husband's there or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm guessing. Yeah.
And so then they just kind of all get they all pile into the wagon and they go back to the Moffat's house for dinner. It cracked me up. Like I think you told me about this book and you were like, okay, they all like have their own they're like always getting into trouble. They're like not mischievous, but they're like,
No, but trouble tends to find them.
yes.
It's really funny, but it's also cute, and they're good kids. That's the thing. They're such good kids. They have such good hearts and good intentions, and they love their mama, and they're always happy to see her. She's like, okay, here comes mama. Everything's gonna be okay. And I love that.
And she just has dinner for him. She's like, just come, let's go eat. I'm not
Yeah,
mad.
that's sweet. Yeah.
That guy didn't seem mad.
I think he was upset at first, but then he kind of heard their side of the story. And I did think, I was like, you know, we don't drive horses and wagons today, but I imagine that would be extremely loud. You know, the
Yeah.
jingle of the everything, you know, the harness and the reins and everything they used to hitch up the horse. So all of that is jingling. The wheels turning on the dirt road would be very, very loud. So it
In the
probably would be
rain.
difficult to, and then the rain, and if they have like a covering, the rain's coming down on the covering, and that's going to be really loud.
I mean, can you imagine your parents would have been like, you never showed up for Sunday school? You just decided to like go on an adventure? Like, she didn't even say anything.
Like, well, you're safe.
Okay.
Which is one thing I was thinking about. So I can't remember. I think Joe is supposed to be like 12, but and he'd never driven a team of horses before. Obviously, that's something that's extremely foreign to us. Not many people drive a horse and wagon. You've got the people that will drive a carriage to charge people a lot of money to take them on a carriage ride. But other than that, it just doesn't happen. But I remember my grandpa talking about how he learned to drive a full team of horses in a wagon when he was 6 years old.
Wow.
And that would have been in the 20s. Crazy. Like, imagine your 6-year-old just up on this wagon. I mean, driving an entire team of horses. And that's really scary because, like, I mean, they're obviously usually very well trained, but if something scares them, they can just take off. Different time, different. It's very interesting.
Yeah, like how would a 6-year-old handle like if something happened?
Yeah, I don't know.
My 6-year-old couldn't. I don't know if like I mean, I've never really talked to my great grandpa. I don't know. I never talked to them about stuff like that. Like if they, my grandpa, I mean, he had to have been born in that time. Like he was born in
Yeah.
19, my great grandpa was born in 1900
Okay. Yeah.
and he died when I was 17. So it's just sad. I never, I mean, maybe I did, and I just don't remember him talk because he talked to me. It's not like I didn't talk to him.
You just
But
don't remember like specific stories.
yeah, now I think about him and I'm like, okay, so he was 90,
Okay, so he
1997.
was.
So he was 97 when he died.
Wow. Okay.
And I'm like, that does not seem that long ago. I know that's sad, but it doesn't because I was, almost an adult. I was 17. But I'm like, he would have been 123 now. You don't live to be 123. I don't know. It just
No.
seems like,
Yeah.
wow. I mean, do you know when are your grandparents still alive?
Just my one grandma she'll be 97 in April. So.
No, all my grandparents have passed away. They all kind of passed away about the same time, like when Sydney was a baby. So, 18 years ago or so.
Okay. Yeah, my two grandpas passed away very like within a month of each other, and that was when Tate was a baby. Yeah.
That's crazy. I know, but just to think like we knew people that would have grown been alive during this. Like, so, I mean, my
Yeah.
grandpa was like a sheep herder. Is that what he called himself? I don't know. He would go up in the mountains and take care of the sheep. So, I
That's cool.
mean, that's a job that people don't do anymore, I think.
Well, they do. They just do it. I mean, I'm sure it's just very different. So actually here they have a parade each year and sort of a festival called Sheep Days because there are lots of shepherds. They keep all their sheep up on the mountain. And then there's a day in the fall where they drive all the sheep down through town, like through Main Street, take them to their winter pasture. So there's some people on horses. A lot of them are riding four-wheelers and stuff. So yes, like it's done differently, but
So why do they keep the sheep in different places during different times of the year? Is it like
I don't know.
warmer?
It's probably just about, where the pastures are and the food and things like that, and the access to food and water, I would think.
I mean, like at my grandpa's funeral, so his dad was the one that was a sheep herder. We talked a lot about how they would all go up there it must be the summer. They would all go up in the mountains
Yeah, I think it's
in
the
the
summer.
summer, and like people would come to visit, and like the kids would take those people, like basically they were like the tour guides. They would take them fishing, they would take them
Oh,
hunting, like
interesting. Okay.
because the kids knew how to do everything.
Yeah.
They were good at everything because they just
Yeah.
go up there and they just play, and it's kind
Yeah,
of.
that's so cool.
Have you had any time to read?
Actually, yes. This week I was like, it doesn't matter what, I'm just going to start a book. Listen to it. And I'm really excited about this one. So it is The Diamond Eye by Kate Quinn. And I was
Oh.
really excited to read another one by her because I had read The Rose Code, loved it. And I know you guys recommend it. You and Nan recommended the Alice Networks. And I still need to do that one. But this one is The Diamond Eye. Have you read this one yet? I think that she, anyway, Kate Quinn is just, she's a wonderful author. So this is the true story of history's deadliest female sniper. And she, yeah, well, so she's from Kiev, so she must be Ukrainian, but she fights for the Russian army during World War II. She just has these different things in her life that lead her to becoming an incredible marksman and just being very determined to never miss. And then when the war breaks out, like when Germany invades Russia, she's like, well, I can be of use. And she has a son, and she's, and her entire motivation is like, I want to keep Russia safe for my boy. And this is what I can contribute. And of course, there's a lot that comes with being a woman who is a sniper. Like that doesn't happen, but she's so good. She's so good. She starts in like 1941, I think. By 1942, she has something like 309 kills, but those are just confirmed kills. So she probably has like maybe even double the number. I don't know, because there has to be like documentation or their witnesses or whatever to say, yes, definitely those were your kills. But she had done so well for herself that like she was like kept ranking up, ranking up, ranking up until she had like her own little platoon of men type thing. Yeah, I haven't finished it yet, but it's very incredible so far, and it's a true story. So, and she became known as, both the Russian army and the Nazi army knew her as Lady Death.
Oh.
And she was just like this just pretty little librarian lady. Like she was, yeah, like that's
Crazy.
what she was trying to do. She was working on her dissertation when the war started, and it was like, well, this is what I can do, and so I'm going to go do it. So
Dave is always telling me that women are really good shots. Like we have really good aim. It's like more natural for us, I think, than for men. Like they have to, maybe, I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I
That
mean,
shows you maybe that's
her
true.
story would suggest that that may be true.
Then you just never know, Lady Death.
Yeah.
Librarian
Yeah.
lady. That sounds interesting. I've
Yeah,
seen
that's
that book, I
super.
think. Okay, so I heard another podcast talking about how when you're podcasting, it's hard because you're usually a couple weeks ahead. You need to read like seasonal books like more ahead so that it's like appropriate when we talk about them. So next year I'm going to do that. I'm reading a Christmas book and this isn't going to come out till January. So I'm sorry,
Okay.
everybody, but it's what I wanted to read. And so I was listening to this podcast called Two Babes in a Book, and they were recommending a book called, and it's a series of seven books, but I think they're all different authors and they're all Christmas books. And so this was the one they were talking about was the second book in the series. It was called Later On We'll Conspire
Oh, nice. Okay.
by Courtney Kiesel. I was listening to them and they were saying, like, but they had read the first book in the series called Faking Christmas by Carrie Winfrey. And so it's all different authors, but this is the same series. And anyways,
Yeah,
so,
they
and they said
kind
they
of tied
really
together
loved it.
something.
Yeah. So they loved it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to listen to Faking Christmas. And I'm loving it.
Oh,
It's
good.
really cute and like sweet. And so there's two English teachers at a high school. One's a man and she's a woman. They're both single. She hates him.
Okay.
Like she just is, I think she's jealous of him because he's got like the kids really like him and he's really cool. And she says, like, they read the Harry Potter or something like that, where she teaches like, you know, Jane Eyre and stuff. And so, and all the kids like now want to be in his class. And so she hates him. He like, she accidentally sends this email to somebody like talking about him, about how attractive he is. And it accidentally goes to him, which I don't know how that happens. But so anyways, they have this problem. She goes on this Christmas vacation with her family. She kind of tells him that she's dating him. She's pretending like she's dating somebody because they brought in this other guy is coming, like an old ex of hers that is coming to on this vacation, and she doesn't want to be set up with him again. So she makes up this story that she's dating this guy and she uses his name. Well, then he shows up at the lodge that they're staying at because his family owns the lodge. And so since she told her family that she was dating him, they have to pretend like they're dating. So it's just kind of, he's
That is cute.
very sweet. It's just entertaining. And it's what, today's Christmas Eve. So I'm sorry for all those that are listening to this in January, but next year
That sounds
I'll.
fun. Honestly, it sounds like something that would be fun any time of year if you just need something that's like just sweet and delightful and
Yeah, it's
fun.
just cute. And there's a lot of references to classic literature and classic movies. And I just, I'm liking it. So.
We love that. Awesome.
There you go. Next year, write it on your list for next year or read
Yeah,
in
seriously.
January.
Seriously.
Okay, so next week we'll do chapters 5 through 8 of
Yes.
The Moffats. And I'm
Yeah.
excited. Yes, I'm really liking it. And it's a good change from Mere Christianity.
Yeah.
Much
We
easier.
went from extremely heavy to very light, just sweet little family story.
Yes.
So, we're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss The Moffats, chapters 5 through 8 by Eleanor Estes. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share a podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.